Welcome to this very special episode of Nobody's Coming to Fix You. Today is special because firstly, we're in a studio in Soho. I have my first male guest and it's the last episode of the first series. This series has been such a joy to make and I can't believe that it was only a few months ago when I spoke to my friend Sally B and said, will you be my guest on the first podcast if I go ahead and do it? And she casually said, yeah, why not? And the rest, as they say, is history. In the last 4 months, we produced 22 episodes. Our guests were amazing. They all had an amazing story to tell, whether it was a huge career and business adventure, whether it was something huge in their personal life, their health, their well-being, whether it's about how they changed themselves through their personal brand, how they handled relationships in their life. We covered so many topics. And the one key thread for this podcast was always that we should be the podcast that gives women tips, tricks, hacks to lead a better life. As most of you know by now, Nobody's Coming to Fix You is part of Santillan. And Santillan is our transformation and coaching program. And Nobody's Coming to Fix You is a part of that. And we know that everybody won't be able to come on the Santillan coaching program, but at least a lot of the guests that are part of that program can also be on our podcast too. What I experienced with my own journey on creating this podcast is exactly the same as what this podcast strategy is. And that is that if you want to do something, you have to get up and get out and make things happen. I always believe in that. And although this podcast wasn't the easiest thing to create in the first instance because I had no experience. I'm not from this world of broadcast and I didn't really know how to go about setting it up, technically managing it, finding the guests, producing it on a weekly basis. Actually, I'm really happy with how it's shaped up in these last weeks. Have there been learnings? Absolutely. So many things that I do differently for our next series. But that just makes me feel really great that I put myself through it. I learned a lot. And now we're in a position to start preparing for series two. What I experienced with my own journey in creating this podcast is actually no different to what the strategy of this podcast actually is. And that is, if you have an idea, if you want to do something, you should just throw yourself in and make it happen. What's the worst that can happen? It may not work. It may not be as good as you expect it to be. It may require you to make more effort, but at least you tried it and at least you've got the learnings. And I think that's how I've really felt throughout this podcast. At the beginning, I didn't know how we would make this happen. I have no skills in podcast production. I have no idea about, you know, booking guests and studios and producing things for Spotify. It all seemed like a bit of a mountain. But somehow, whenever you put it out there that you want to do something, the universe always kicks in. And suddenly all these podcast fairies turned up in my life and started helping me and assisting me with this or this. And it became really easy. And I just, as we wrap up the first series, would like to thank the Podcast Boutique, who have been an amazing team of people who have produced this podcast. And if any of you listening to this want to produce a podcast, I think you could do a lot worse than go to Podcast Boutique. So they're a great team of people. And on this podcast, I'm going to put their details in the show notes as well. But they came through and they helped and they've supported all the way. We've also had amazing guests. And I want to thank each and every one of the guests who are very, very busy women, time poor, with lots of pressures, and they probably get requests for podcasts every single day of the week. A lot of them gave up their time knowing that this is a brand new podcast and we don't have a huge following at the moment. So I'm very grateful for those women to give up their time. Hello and welcome to Nobody's Coming to Fix You, a podcast for women, by women, talking all things life, empowerment and transformation. My name is Del Beer. I'm a businesswoman, sustainability advocate, industry leader in my field, and have spent my whole career working in the fashion industry, working out what women actually want. I am the creator of the Santillan Coaching and Transformation Program, and I'm your host for this podcast. Joining me throughout the series will be lots of fabulous women, and men too, to talk about how we can share the best hacks to live our best lives. Welcome to today's episode of Nobody's Coming to Fix You. I'm delighted to be joined today by Matthew Jukes renowned wine writer and the mastermind behind Duke's Cordialities, a fantastic alcohol alternative drink. Matthew, thank you so much for being here. Matthew, you've had a remarkable career in the world of wine. Tell us about your career.
It's a long one. I celebrated my 38th birthday in the wine trade the other day.
Wow.
So that's quite long, really. It's now nearly 40 years, not over 30 years when I write it down. I've done all disciplines in the trade, really. I've started off working in retail, which is where everyone should really start. You know, it's fun, it's kind of racy, it's kind of interacting with the general public. It's, you get a chance to taste lots of wines. And I enjoyed that enormously. But then sort of went to, I think, the pinnacle of the job quite quickly, which is buying. When you're a buyer, you have this sort of power. You're out to stroll around everywhere, buying whatever you want, you know, with an open checkbook. I loved all of that. And I got a great job buying for a restaurant called Bibendum Restaurant.
Yes.
In the Michelin building on the Fulham Road in London. And that was back in 1990. So I was quite young. I was very lucky to have quite a prestigious job. I didn't work on the floor, so I wasn't a sommelier as such. I was in the office, and that afforded me time to go to all the wine tastings in London. So I was tasting every day. And of course, your knowledge just grows, you know, exponentially. And then, because the list was already quite famous, I was able to sort of augment it with wines that I thought, with my sort of young palate and adventurous palate, were pretty exciting. So it changed from being quite a traditional wine list with the predictable styles of wine into being a mix of that and then some pretty exciting new stuff, you know, a bit of California, a bit of Australia, a lot of Australia, New Zealand and South Africa, and really pushing the boundaries.
What was new at the time?
New at the time, it was Cloudy Bay had just kicked off. So Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc kicked off in 87. So that was sort of fairly new. New Zealand was sort of expanding quite rapidly. But I was odd because I had two full pages, about 100 wines from Australia, which must be something of a record and certainly was back then. So I had as much kind of Aussie wine as I did Bordeaux, for example.
Right.
And that was strange. And it really sort of cemented my enthusiasm for Australia. I had a lot of Italians as well. And yet the food, back then, Simon Hopkinson was the chef, and he was one of the sort of founders of modern British food, you know, along with Alice Little and Rayleigh Lee and Sally Clark and that bunch, you know, really cool people. And so the food wasn't just French or just English or just Italian or whatever. It was a mix of everything. And that afforded me the chance to make the list, the wine list, global. Because there was always something that would go with something else. And so I became quite obsessed with food and wine pairing. And that led on to a job in the radio. You know, I went to work for BBC. I went to work for GLR, which was 94.9 FM station for London. I did a breakfast slot with Fee Glover and Gideon Coe every week. Yeah, yeah, it was an amazing show. Every week at 7:20 in the morning, talking about wine. People thought it was hilarious. Yeah, we'd be tasting wine at 7:20. Yeah, seriously. I'd ride in from Barnes on my motorbike with a couple of bottles of wine strapped to the back and some glasses, and we'd crack on with whatever wine I'd found that week and have a hilarious time, often do a few competitions or giveaways or whatever. And then it became a little bit more sort of well-known, and I was given half an hour a week. So the same sort of time slot as best cinema reviews or best theatre or whatever. And because it was early in the morning, anyone that landed at Heathrow from down under or whatever, they could get to the studio for the same time as my show. So I did interviews, started to interview people. Amazing people. I mean, thinking back, it was incredible. And I got loads of scoops and people launched wines on air. And you know, it was really, really cool.
Oh, my God. Why don't we have anything like this now?
We don't have anything like it at all. It's a disaster.
It's such a shame. I mean, that sounds so exciting. I mean, you know, wake up in the morning, you're grumpy.
Yeah.
What better than to turn on the radio and listen to an interesting conversation about wine?
That's right. And it's sort of, I don't know, it was slightly irreverent. I mean, Fee's amazing broadcaster, and Gideon Coe is brilliant. So there was a lot of humour involved. And they let me play music. And they, you know, I used to go to gigs a lot, and I used to bring in sort of, you know, ideas for music. So it was sort of a bit loose. There's quite a lot of sweary stuff going on. You know, and then the switchboard would light up and people going, you can't say that at 7 o'clock in the morning, you fool. So that was quite fun. And that led on to being offered a TV series. So I presented a TV series for Channel 4 called Wine Hunt, which was a sort of glorified game show teaching punters about wine. And we travelled around France and did a series of sort of, I suppose, exercises or tests or whatever to broaden their knowledge about wine. And that did really well. Then I was offered a job by the Daily Mail, writing about wine on Saturdays and Weekend Magazine. I did that for 22 years.
Really?
Yeah. Big audience, powerful newspaper, and huge amount of fun writing about 5 or 6 wines a week for 22 years. There's a lot of columns.
And do you travel all over the world?
Yeah, that obviously alerted people around the world to my writing, and therefore I was invited to go to, you know, various countries and taste and judge. I did a lot of judging. And I then wrote for Money Week. I still write for Money Week every Friday. Done that for 17 years, nearly 18 years. And I wrote lots of books, wrote 14 books in the course of those years.
And what were the books about?
Wine, of course, but generally buyer's guides.
14 books on wine?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I became a writer from being a bloke who failed his English O-level and, you know, could barely string two words together. It was the radio show that sort of got... I suppose it was the fluidity of the describing wine, and then all I did was just write down what I would say. And people liked it because it was quite sort of musical and quite easy to understand, nothing too technical. And I hated stuffy, old-school wine writing. I just liked sort of the passion of wine and how wine makes you feel and who you should drink your beautiful wines with and how much fun you should have, as opposed to, you know, bringing it all back down to sort of academia. And I haven't stopped. I still do that. I just don't write books now.
You don't write books now. But no. You still have a column.
Yeah, in Money Week every Friday, I still write monthly for Vineyard Magazine, which is quite a sort of highbrow mag on English wines and Welsh wines. But I write massive reports for my website. I mean, really proper, serious, in-depth reports on Bordeaux, Burgundy, Australia, Piemonte in Northern Italy, and then a lot about English wines as well.
So that brings me on to the next kind of big question. So why does somebody with so much wine knowledge, so much wine experience, then create this amazing drink that I'm in love with, Duke's Cordialities, an alcohol alternative drink?
It's literally, that's the reason. It's an alternative. Right. The reason is very simple. Everyone's experienced this. You go to a restaurant and for whatever reason, you're not drinking. You don't have to sort of tell people what the reason is. You just don't fancy alcohol. And you're offered Coca-Cola, Fanta, apple juice.
Orange juice, or
just more coffee, yeah. You know, just, you know, coffee, or tea or whatever. You've just ordered delicious food. Mm. So you want something to go with the food that isn't a kiddie's drink, basically. Mm. You treat it like an adult. And it really annoyed me. And it started to sort of get on top of me a bit. Until I was sitting in a restaurant with a friend of mine, an American friend of mine, Jack Holohan. And I said, Jack, I'm just going to solve this problem. He said, really? Come on, let's do it together. Let's do something really cool. And a couple of years later, a lot of research, a lot of messing around. Yeah, we launched Duke's. And that was 4.5 years ago.
I mean, there's so much I can say about this, but let's go from the beginning. So first of all, let's just talk about the different types of drink that you've created and the way you identify them, which is very different.
Yeah, everything's a bit me. So it's a bit sort of slightly strange, but it makes sense to me. And everyone has to sort of catch up, I suppose. It's, look, I didn't know how to create a drink that gave you the satisfaction of wine, the complexity of wine, the perfume of wine, the dry finish of wine, because dryness and tartness and bitterness is very mouthwatering. It's delicious. You don't want a sweet drink. No. You want an unhealthy drink. I thought, how on earth can I create something new? It must have been done before. And of course, it had been done before. And I looked back in the history books, because all the answers to all the problems of the world, you can find them in history. And I found this drink called Haymaker's Punch. This glorious name. Literally, the farm worker would drink this as a sort of energy drink, Gatorade or whatever, during the day when, you know, working in the fields and they were hot and sweaty. And I thought, God, I love the sound of that. What's it made from? And of course, you can see the old recipes and old books. In fact, someone very kindly sent me a book from the 1800s that has this recipe written out. And It's made, this haymaker's punch is made from the leftovers from a farmhouse table. So your typical farmhouse table. You've got your fruit and veg. They've all got apples, so they've made vinegar. So it's an apple cider vinegar maceration. All the leftovers from the fruit and the veg that you don't eat, so the knobbly bits and the pips and the core seeds, stuff like that, you just bang it into the vinegar for a couple of days. And the vinegar does a job of extracting the flavour and the colour and the perfume of whatever you shove in it. So if you shove a whole lot of strawberries in, or not the nice bit of strawberry, the hulls and the bits you don't eat, shove all those in, you'll end up with a strawberry-flavoured vinegar. Now, you know that from cooking, because people do that at home with a sprig of thyme or rosemary or garlic or whatever. But if you do it with tasty things, you can make quite a tasty drink. And that drink was called the Haymaker's Punch. It went over to America, became known as a shrub or a switchel, and they became really famous during Prohibition, because you're not allowed to drink booze, but in these, you know, in these large farms, large properties, they had, you know, pineapples or apples, lemons, peaches, whatever. Beautiful fruit to make very complex, very luscious, very tasty drinks. And they became a mark of pride of the great families, had the most beautiful drinks to offer their guests. Very convivial thing to do, offer someone a beautiful alcohol-free drink when they walk in your door. Of course, when booze was allowed to be consumed again, these sort of recipes disappeared and people forgot about them. And they were kept on by pharmacies, really, as a sort of medicinal drink. Quite simple ones, because of the apple cider vinegar, super good for your gut health, really good for your skin, good for cholesterol, good for everything, basically. Apple cider vinegar is just a miracle liquid. But the practice of drinking this drink with food was largely lost, and they were consumed either as a sort of tonic, like a medical tonic, or in a bar as part of a cocktail. Okay. So bar people would make their own versions and use that to make a signature cocktail that you couldn't have in the next hotel or whatever. So that's where the drink has sort of largely, this style of drink has largely sort of retained its status. However, in the UK, it's gone. So I resurrected this idea, but with a view, and this was the bit that I didn't know if it was possible, with a view to making a highly complex drink that was somehow the same shape or the same silhouette as wine. So a white, a rosé, and a red that looks like wine in the glass, that smells complex and engaging and attractive like a wine, that tastes mouth-filling, so luscious, luxurious, but then when you swallow it, is completely refreshing and dry and cleansing, a bit like a wine. And I only managed to sort of get close to the target after, you know, nearly 2 years of practicing and evolving the method and using complex recipes. So I use about 160 ingredients across the drinks.
160?
Yeah, it's a busy kitchen is basically what we have at Duke's, a big kitchen where we chop up fruit, veg, herbs, spices and flowers and macerate them in the vinegar. And then you create a cordial. From that cordial, I can make my drinks.
And I heard somewhere that you have discarded grape skins.
Yeah. Okay, so the classic cordialities are numbered.
Right.
So one is a white.
Yep.
Eight is a rosé. Six is a dark red. There are five in total. Three of them I put into cans in this ready-to-drink format. But there's a sort of cousin. There's a sort of hybrid, off to the side, a diffusion brand, which is called Duke's Sparkling Pinot Noir. And everyone's going, sparkling Pinot, that's wine! Okay, well, it's made from Pinot Noir grape skins. Yes, that's true.
Right.
But it's not fermented, so it's not wine.
Yeah.
Wine is fermented grape must and, you know, skins and the rest of it. I don't ferment the skins. I just macerate them in the aforementioned vinegar and create a Pinot Noir-scented and flavoured drink. And it's, I mean, it's heaven. The great thing about that particular drink is the skins are effectively rubbish.
Yeah.
Because the vineyards that grow these Pinot Noir grapes, when the grape bunches are picked and they're taken to the winery crushes the grapes, the juice comes out, and the juice is made into wine, a white wine, even though they're red grapes. The red grape skins are not needed. they're thrown on the compost heap or given to livestock or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I've basically made a drink out of the leftovers.
So ultra sustainable.
Mega sustainable. It's brilliant. But also, that's where all the flavour and the colour is in the skin.
Yeah.
You actually don't want that in your white sparkling wine, but I sure as hell want it in my pink sparkling drink. So actually, I've got all that energy from the skins. It's not lost. I use it.
So do you go around vineyards then and picking up their discarded grape skins?
Yeah. So we designed bins, big bins that you sort of push underneath the grape press. And once the press has sort of pressed the grapes and the juice has come off and gone off to be fermented, you open a hatch on the bottom of the grape press and all the skins just fall out into my bin. And then I just drive them back, literally, an eight-ton truck, I think it was. It was the scariest thing I've ever done. Back to Battersea, where I make the drinks. You know, if I get them back before they start fermenting, great. But if I, you know, if say I stopped in the lay-by overnight, the sugars would start fermenting and I'd have a sort of, you know, a mildly alcoholic grape slush in the back of my truck. So I've got to move fast.
You have to go really quickly.
Yeah, really fast. And at cold temperature. It's better to be cold temperature. That inhibits fermentation.
Now, Battersea was not the location I was thinking you were going to mention when it came to, you know, alcohol alternative production. I thought we were going to be in Kent or Sussex or somewhere, but...
No, it's in Battersea. I live in Battersea. And in Battersea, those of you that have been to Battersea and seen it, there are loads and loads of train tracks that, of course, are above ground. And they head into Waterloo or to Victoria or wherever. And underneath the train tracks are loads of Victorian railway arches. And there's so much artisan business going on all these arches all over southwest London. And I got two of those arches in Battersea where I make my drinks.
Really?
No, serious.
Oh, I cannot wait to come and see your place.
It's remarkable. I mean, it's like a sort of the inside of a church, I suppose. It's big brick arch. And inside, I've got this sort of space age kitchen, which is all stainless steel and white surfaces. And then there's no gizmos. It's just chopping boards and knives. And, you know, my lovely team cuts a cucumber up precisely to macerate into vinegar or an orange or an apple or whatever the ingredients are.
All hand done.
All hand done. We don't buy, you know, purees or oils or, you know, there's no cheating. It has to be done from scratch and from fresh fruit and veg. And of course, we're close to Covent Garden Market, so we can just get everything in seconds, literally half a mile away.
Now, on this podcast today, and for those of you who are listening, you won't be able to see it, we have actually got a selection of the drinks. So, but I want to make sure that I get through all of them throughout this podcast. So I've just had number one, which is the sparkling, which is fantastic. This was the one that we had on our retreat.
Yeah.
And Matthew and his team very kindly gave us some Jukes to take away on our retreat that we had at the Wilderness Reserve at the end of February, early March. This particular drink was so popular amongst the guests. It was really interesting because I didn't want to create a retreat where there were rules. I didn't want to say, oh, we're on a retreat, you can't drink alcohol, or, you know, you will do this or you will eat this. It was really a relaxed environment. In fact, we also had fabulous wines from Burnt House in Suffolk, 27 miles away from the retreat where we were staying. Beautiful, beautiful wines. They're amazing. So we gave everybody the choice. We were like, you can have these gorgeous wines that are literally produced from down the road.
Yeah.
You can have Jukes. You can drink anything else. It was so interesting that with all of that choice and no judgment whatsoever, people kept on gravitating towards Jukes.
Good. I mean, they are yummy, but there's a sort of side kind of... I didn't plan this. Honestly, I worked around flavour, perfume, you know, the experience. The wine-mimicking experience. But they're really healthy.
Yeah.
And that's the vinegar, for a start. Yeah. I mean, it's just so good for you. However, the calories in these drinks are so low.
How many calories, on average, are there in a can?
For 100 mils, because that's what everyone knows.
Yeah.
Because the cans are 250-mil cans. But Jukes 1 is 16 calories for a glass. Jukes 8 is 13. That's the rosé. And Jukes 6, which is the big daddy, the dark red, is only 17.
Wow.
So it's a fifth or a sixth of a glass of wine.
So really healthy, no sugar.
And they feel healthy.
Yeah, they really do. And they feel really refreshing as well. Mm. That was the thing that everybody kept on saying. So we've just drank Jukes 1, which is the sparkling white.
Yeah.
So which one? Eight. Number eight. Okay,
eight's so... Eight's the rosé.
Number eight is the rosé, okay.
So
and if this is going to be on YouTube, then there it is, actually. So, I've got some more glasses in case you need to change your glass or anything.
I'm very happy to try these. The eight's rosé, and you can see colour-wise, it is the archetypal colour of a rosé champagne. And that's not because we use colouring. It's because the maceration is made of things like raspberries, cherries, rhubarb, you know, pink things, melon, watermelon, cranberry, pomegranate. And that's what colours the vinegar and makes it that colour.
Ah, that is amazing. That is so good. That is such a good rosé, actually. And the thing is, I think this was a thing, like you call it, your phraseology is alcohol alternatives.
Yeah.
Which I really like, because actually I think for the first time, this is an alternative. You know, you often go to those work parties and they have those like awful drinks like, you know, like Nosecco, which I always call like, no, thank you. You know, like they're so terrible, you know. But actually, I think this, even when you have a choice of alcohol or Jukes, I quite possibly would choose Jukes.
You're sort of rewarding your palate with a, you know, relatively sophisticated sort of luxurious flavour, which is great. So you don't feel like you're missing out. And actually, I've been selling Jukes in going to Paris quite a lot recently, and putting Jukes into the sort of French market. And their expression is, you join the dance. Mm. So you're invited to the dance, and you join the dance. So it's inclusivity is their thing. Yeah. You don't want to be left on the sidelines of the dance. You want to be on the dance floor. That's the French expression. I think that's rather lovely, because why should you? Why should you have a sort of lesser drink just because you don't want alcohol? It doesn't make sense.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's why sometimes people just do order a drink, because you don't want to go to the bar and have a Diet Coke or an apple juice or whatever. And like you said, sometimes you're driving, sometimes you just don't want to drink. Sometimes you want to be healthier. You don't want a hangover.
Everyone's cutting down. Yeah. I mean, everyone. You're not drinking booze every day. I mean, even I taste wine every day, but I don't drink wine every day. You think I do, but I don't.
It's, you know, it's really interesting you say that. So like, I think Gen Z especially, you know, their relationship with wine is so different to everyone that's gone before. And the amount of people I know in their 20s who just say, oh, I just don't really drink. You know,
bothered, yeah.
I mean, and the prices now as well. That's right. It's so prohibitive. And, you know, people going into a pub and saying, oh, God, like a medium glass of wine is like, you know, £11 or £12.
Nuts,
people can't afford it. So there's this whole switch away. I think the timing is so interesting. Like, what is your sort of vision for Jukes now? Where do you think you're going to go with this?
When we started, we launched just at the beginning of 2020, so it wasn't ideal timing with the pandemic and the rest of it. But about approximately 20% of visits to pubs and bars and restaurants was alcohol-free back then, about 20%. It's now a third in London. And weirdly, it's a third in Paris as well, hence the fact I'm going out to Paris quite a lot, because a lot of, as you said, younger people don't really follow what their parents have done. Of course, French being great wine drinkers. If the parents are still banging on about wine all the time, the kids are not going to do that. They're going to do something different. And so if a third of the visits to anywhere, you know, where you're going to go and drink anything, so a restaurant, bar, a club, whatever, or alcohol free, you're sure as hell not going to drink, you know, fizzy drinks because they're so sugary. So what are you going to drink? I've made this drink, and there are other, you know, there are low no beers, there are low no kind of spirits, sort of substitutes, faux spirits, etc. They're all, you know, having a go. Some of them are catching on. Some of them are pretty good. And so that's the way things are going. And I don't think it's going to be, would you like alcohol or not alcohol? It's what would you like to drink? What do you fancy? And then there won't be this stigma. Same thing happened with food, didn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm vegan or I'm vegetarian or whatever. Before it was like, really? God, I mean, it's like, what you mean I've got to go and tell chef to cook something different just for you? And now it's completely accepted. So I think this is going to be such a fast transformation from, you know, being an outcast to being just normal.
Yeah.
Completely normal. Why shouldn't it be?
And I think that, like, I always wonder whether we're going to get to a place where we're going to have, like, alcohol-free bars.
They exist in, there are a couple in New York already.
Really?
Yeah, there are a couple, around the world there are a couple.
Oh, I didn't realise.
Doing quite complex cocktails and stuff, you know, they're pretty fancy places. I think they're sort of a little bit of an anomaly at the moment, but the alcohol-free offering is certainly getting more complex and more interesting. in restaurants now.
And you are in many top Michelin restaurants in London.
Well, that my sort of life being a wine writer, I know a lot of the sommeliers, I know a lot of chefs with my sort of restaurant heritage. I mean, I used to own a wine bar on the Fulham Road in the old days in the 90s. Called the Crescent. It was next to Bibendum Restaurant. Lovely little wine bar opposite Pelham Crescent. And so I'm used to that community. I love restaurateurs. I love it when it's done well. It really impresses me greatly. And so it was quite easy for me to pick up the phone to the best people in town. Then it was a matter of, do you like the drinks or not? And luckily, a lot of them did. And so we got ourselves into a few of the really serious places. So places like Alain Ducasse at the Dorchester and Court by Claire Smith. I mean, Claire is just a genius. Yeah. And then, you know, we're poured at the Woolsey, for example. You know, Woolsey's a great place to sort of just go and chill out, and you can have breakfast, you can have beautiful lunch, brunch, whatever, and you can have early supper before theatre. And Duke's is the sort of thing you want during those occasions. I mean, of course, you don't have to have Duke's. You can have a bottle of red for main course, then go back to a Duke's at the end. And yes, we built up a really lovely list of stockists and a couple of the sort of smart retailers as well. And I'm doing that across the world.
And like, where would you go if you're going to a bar in London? Where would you find Duke's?
Golly. The Woolsey's the most obvious one because everybody knows where Piccadilly is.
Yeah.
But equally, I mean, you could be out in Clapham, for example, and go to Trinity, which I love.
Okay.
You know, Adam Byatt's cooking. It's got one Michelin star. And upstairs at Trinity is a sort of separate restaurant above the Michelin star restaurant. It's a beautifully relaxed kind of sharing plates and gorgeous airy room. And he serves Jukes, but he serves them in a slightly different way, slightly different twist. He sort of, you know, he has a little, it's a Shirley Temple type style Jukes. Then he makes a little sort of lemony kind of an infusion-y type Jukes. So he doesn't want to do what everyone else does. He does it his way. I find that happening quite a lot. I quite like it when people sort of take the drinks one step further, add a bit of garnish or do something interesting with them. So I'm always keen on inventive people. Lawn's a brilliant restaurant. Not many people know it. In just behind Victoria Station, Katie Exton, she's ex-River Cafe and Shea Bruce, and she's a fabulous restaurateur, fabulous, proper palate. Mm. And she serves Dukes, and it's on the top of her list. And then one day, I was sitting there, I was going out for some friends for supper, and I looked at the menu. It's a set menu. So you order your starters and mains, then the menu comes back for pudding, to choose your pudding. And I looked at it, and it said, mango something something with an ice cream or whatever, and mangoes marinated in Duke's One.
No way.
And she'd taken the little concentrated cordial bottles of Duke's One. Chef had just drizzled it over this sort of mango. It was off the scale, and I'd not spotted it when I'd ordered my starters and main. I just went so embarrassed. I went completely bright red. So honoured. You know, so people are really thinking about how these flavours can be evolved in all manner, you know, as a drink, but also in their cooking as well.
I'm thinking that people are going to listen to this and they're going to think, right, when I next go to a pub at the weekend or to a bar, that's something I want to try.
Well, cans are not as portable as the little classic cordialities and the little bottles.
Yeah.
I know thousands of people that have them in their backpacks or in their handbags or in their bum bags or whatever.
Oh, they take them.
The little, and that's right. And then they just... surreptitiously take the top off.
They're not in good pubs yet.
No, not yet. We've only been going for a couple of years, so we haven't quite got there. No. But
I bet the demand would be huge.
Yeah, we're lucky enough to be in places like Selfridges and Fortnum's and, you know, some of the Smarty Pants retailers. And actually Waitrose takes the sparkling Pinot Noir, the cans of sparkling Pinot Noir, which is really lovely. But yeah, we're a small business and we're, you know...
Oh, but it's so exciting. I think it's just, I mean, for me, I was blown away when... First of all, we saw the packaging.
That's another story.
Yeah, tell me.
Oh, this is one of my favourite stories of all time. So back when I owned my wine bar, the Crescent, in the 90s, I had no money to do the interior decoration, the design of this wine bar. And a friend of mine, who is my sort of business partner, Paul Medhurst, he said, I know two lads who are at the Royal College of Art up the road. And we could probably get them to come and help us out. And these boys, because they were boys, were called Jason Osgoby and Ed Barber, Jay and Ed. And they came in and very quickly transformed this shell of a restaurant into something really quite eye-catching. Lots of routed wood, blonde wood and zinc bar and galvanised steel. And it was modern, but it was really beautiful and inexpensive. That was the main thing. And they designed a piece of furniture for the basement of my bar. And it was a low coffee table, beautiful piece of design, very, very simple. And it was sort of steam bent wood in a sort of loop shape. And I just thought, oh, God, that's heaven. But lads, we're going to be sitting on bar stools. It's not going to be sofas and low tables. So I can't take it. So I rejected this table. OK, I didn't realise that they took it to Milan and Capellini commissioned it. And it became, it's called the loop table, it became one of the most iconic pieces of 20th century furniture design in the UK. It sits in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. It's in the Design Museum in London. It's in the V&A Permanent Furniture Exhibition. And I'd rejected it.
Not for me, lads.
No, sorry, lads.
It doesn't work.
No. So that's, on the one hand, is tragic, but quite amusing. All these years later, when I start to work on the Jukes project, I thought, come on, let's just phone them up because they're so famous. They're called Barber Osgoby. Look them up. They, I mean, you'll know their work.
Yeah.
They're very much into furniture and lighting, and they work with Sir Paul Smith and Rimowa Suitcases, and you know, they're very, very cool guys. And I said, look, could you help me with the packaging for my? I've got these little bottles, and I need to make them look nice, and they need to look clean and sophisticated. And then, you know, down the line, I expect there'll be cans because I hadn't released the cans then. And they said, well, only if it tastes good. Again, same rules. I'll help you if it tastes delicious. And they loved the flavours of the drinks. And then they set about their work.
And this is their...
Yeah.
This is their work.
I think this is a thing. I think the packaging is so contemporary. It feels really stylish. It doesn't feel like a soft drink. It doesn't feel like a poor man's alternative. It just feels, it feels really stylish. And I can see why it kind of turns up in all of those like prestigious restaurants. Now, before I go any further, I am going to go for the third one
Me too.
So that's number six.
Yeah, Duke Six. This is the dark red. And it's, I mean, the colour alone is a bit of a showstopper. And the colour obviously comes from the ingredients. And therefore you can guess, you know, black currants and blackberries are involved for sure. But a lot of the depth of the colour here, because it really does look like a lusty red wine in the glass, comes from beetroot. So that's a big hint about the fact that in my drinks, fruit is very important, of course, because fruit gives you the lusciousness and the texture. But I call it anti-fruit. So anything that isn't fruit, i.e. the veg, the herbs, the spices and the edible flowers, give you the complexity. And they counterbalance, a bit of a seesaw. If they're in balance, a bit like wine, in wine you'd be talking about fruit, oak, alcohol, acid, you know, those sort of elements of a wine. In these drinks, because there's no alcohol there, every other element has to be in balance. And therefore I can see them as sort of three-dimensional shapes when I'm blending. And I just want them to be complete. Can't be any sort of gaps or fissures or cracks. And beetroot's an incredibly important ingredient here, because beetroot on its own has super depth of flavour, but also earthiness. And earthiness gives you, as the French would say, the goût de terroir. It's the sense of the earth, which is what the great wines have, because they have a sense of place. They're linked to a vineyard, to a chateau or whatever, to a hillside. And that's why you want to buy them, because you want to buy a slice of that hillside, that flavour. So I'm sort of faking that, let's say, with a sense of earth in Duke Six by the use of root vegetables. It's fun, isn't it?
It's absolutely wonderful. I mean, this podcast is designed for women to empower them, to help give them tips, tricks and hacks to improve their life. I think a lot of women talk about their relationship with alcohol.
Yeah.
Especially if they're like busy and they're stressed out, and then often it's just going to come home and just open a bottle of wine, and you know, before you know it, you're halfway, you know, through a bottle of wine and you haven't even noticed it.
It's that sort of 6 o'clocker, and it just knocks you back at least an hour and a half, and then by then you'll think, actually, do you know what? I can't be bothered to open a bottle now. I'm not going to.
Do you know what? And that's exactly what I was doing. At the retreat, we were like, when we would finish in the early evening and then we'd go back to our bedrooms to get changed for dinner, yeah. I'd take one of these and say, right, I'll just get ready and I'll have it whilst I'm getting ready. Same thing when I went to Spain with my family. I managed to get it from Waitrose. Oh, and I brilliant. Put it in my case and put them in the fridge when we got there. And then, like, just as we were getting ready for dinner, I'd be, like, asking everyone if they wanted, like a Jukes. And often if you've had a couple of glasses of it, you've kind of, like, you've got past the moment where you think you need a glass of wine.
Yeah, because they're satiating. There's a lot of flavour there and a lot of complexity. There's upwards of 20 ingredients in each of these drinks. And therefore, your brain is fizzing away in the background, thoroughly excited about, the flavours you've given it to dissect. But it's not stopping you from continuing your chat because, you haven't just slowed down. Everyone, silence, please. We're just about to have a sip. at least you can keep chatting. Yes. And unlike, ultra fine wine where everyone has to sort of pray at the beauty of the wine. Yeah, they're kind of lighthearted as well.
Yeah.
Happy-go-lucky. And weirdly, and this is something that people are not quite into just yet, but they will get to, I think, probably, is with the little cordial bottles, my little concentrator bottles, they're only 3 centilitres. They go a long way when you dilute them with water, of course. But if you use tonic water with them, then they become stupidly complex cocktails. Like crazy. Like you couldn't make them at home if you had all day. Because, of course, they've got so many ingredients in them. But all you have to do is just chuck it in some tonic. And then you get this sort of, Duke Six particularly looks like a kind of, thoroughly masterful Negroni in the glass. And it took you 14 seconds to make, shoving the ice cubes in, you could put a slice of blood orange in the top if you want as well. And you've just made something that people will go weak at the knees for. It's completely alcohol free.
Now, talking about fine alcohol, yeah. I'm really, when we spoke last time, and we could have spoken for forever about this whole conversation around the British wine industry and just how exciting it is at the moment. And every time I talk to anybody in either Sussex or Suffolk, they're always talking about how, French vineyard owners are coming over and buying up the land and that we're going to become like the right place in terms of climate and temperature.
We already are.
Are we?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, gosh, Champagne is, a long way north in France, and therefore it's one of the cooler regions, if not the coolest region in France, and that's why sparkling wine works so well there. But Champagne is getting warmer. Mm. Global warming's happening everywhere. Climate change is a massive thing, as we all know. And when you warm and you heat up a wine region, the grapes inevitably are going to be riper at harvest time. So the sugar levels are going to be higher. Therefore, the potential alcohols are going to be higher. But what you're losing is acidity, so freshness.
Right.
So as sugar grows, acidity wanes in the grapes. And Champagne is based on acidity. It's that crispness that gives you that beautiful flavour and also means these wines can age. That's why people have vintage Champagne that you can age for a really long time. Now, with Champagne getting a bit warmer, it's going to become more difficult to make ultra-fine wines. And we are a long way north of Champagne. And so we stand a chance of making super wine here. And of course, we've been doing it for many years, many decades. But we've been refining our skills in the last 10 years. And some of the wines are truly spectacular.
They really are.
Really serious.
I mean, I can't believe it. And I think that I'm glad that the price point also reflects that quality, because I don't know whether it was a conscious decision by the vineyard owners to position in line with some of the French.
Yeah, there's a bit of that, but you can't do it cheaply.
You can't do it cheaply, right?
It's very labour intensive. The method of production of sparkling wine, traditional method sparkling wine, or the Champagne method, if you want to call it that, actually takes a couple of years. So you're holding on to stock for a long time before you sell it. It's not unusual for sparkling wines to be 10 years old when they're sold. When they launched, you can hold on to all of those thousands of bottles for 10 years. It's very expensive. So there is an inbuilt premium for that. But also, just farming, it's super specialist farming. It's elite farming. So you need highly skilled people to do it. You need a lot of know-how, and in the south of, not just the south of England, the Midlands as well, and actually Wales. I've just written a piece about Welsh wines. Yeah, there are a couple of really smart producers in Wales. These people are passionate people because they're committed their life to
to being, you know, rather glamorous farmers, because that's ultimately it's farming, isn't it? Farming grapes. But you need massively deep pockets before you start to make a return.
Really?
Yeah.
I am so excited about this space. I mean, we spoke last time. I want to do my vineyard tour this year.
Yeah,
and I'm going to be really tapping you for a lot of information there, because I'm fascinated. I think it's going to be super exciting to see the UK become the kind of like the destination. The thing that keeps me up at night is that, what are we going to call it? Because English Sparkling Wine is just too long a bloody name, right? Yeah, yeah. And we can't call it like Sussex or Suffolk, because then the others will get upset, you know. So we're going to need a name.
A couple of wineries have jumped on a name which isn't great, but it's Britannia. With a the champagne, the end of champagne with Brit at the beginning of it. And it's like, oh, I don't like that so much. So that's not going to work.
No.
I don't know.
One of our issues, though,
maybe. Maybe the brands will just supersede that, though.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, you'd hope that would be the case. Maybe. Because champagne's a place, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why we can't call it, if everything was produced in, like, I don't know, Suffolk or something, yeah. maybe that would become a drink. But I can't think of any British place that has the same kind of impact.
And actually, you sort of want the ability to be able to blend cross county as well, because you can get complexity of flavour by doing that. So you don't want to limit yourself unless you specifically want to make a single vineyard wine from one site. But it's not the be all and end all. Blending is a really great skill, and it's critical when you're making sparkling wine to layer flavour. So, yeah, look, with regard to your tour, you have to have a cabriolet motor car. Because you've got to take the top down, you've got to get the wind blowing through your hair, and you know your sunglasses on, and then I'll just do a sort of route around the south of England, where you can just stop from winery to winery, and get the essence of the area, and then drink the area, understand the area, and then drive on and do the same thing at the next place, and just you'll notice the topography changes. The flavours change. The soil, of course, the soils are changing.
Yeah.
The hillsides are changing. And if you do it, I don't know how long you're going to commit to this, but a week or two or whatever.
I thought about 2 weeks.
Yeah. And then stay in the... Don't stay in a generic hotel chain. Stay in the places as well, because many of them have either shepherd's huts or guest cottages or whatever. You'll be an expert by the time you get back home.
Honestly, this is like, this is my summer holiday.
Yeah,
I've decided this year, this is what I'm going to do. And I can't wait. I mean, I'm so fascinated, because I think on the one hand, I am really excited about what's happening in the UK on the wine scene. I'm super excited about Dukes, and not just because you're here today, but because I was able to experience firsthand a group of women build a relationship with it.
Yeah.
And I think that was a bit of an eye-opener for me.
Yeah,
and
it was
really nice. There was a lot on offer at our retreat. We were really kind of went to town on like food and drink. We didn't want anyone to kind of feel like, you know, that the retreat had rules or they were missing out. And when there's a lot of alcohol choices and people still were like, oh, I think I'll just have another, I'll have another Dukes. And I was like, actually, I'm looking forward to the next kind of months and years where this becomes, not just mainstream, but just is more readily available in bars and places like that as well.
I had a marvellous email this morning come in from a college in Cambridge, where the head of the ball committee, you know, obviously has the job of employing the right bands and the right entertainment and trying to find the right wine merchant to supply them, and obviously a brewer to get the beers in. And they just sent me an order for 600 cans of Dukes.
Really?
Like, okay, that's fantastic. Seriously. And they know that the demand is there and they want to have the best. Like, wow, how things have changed. Yeah, they're thinking, consciously thinking about those people that don't drink alcohol, or in fact, you know, come off a dance floor, having, you know, boogieing away for a while. You definitely want a nice cold Dukes one. You don't want to have a glass of wine, as it's not refreshing, is it?
No.
You'll go back to wine later on or beer later on, but a nice, you know, ice cold Dukes one to cool you down. But colleges are thinking about this now on behalf of their students. Let's be responsible. Let's get something, you know, healthy and delicious, and something that you can feel is luxurious, because you've spent a lot of money on the ticket to this event.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I was just amazed. I'm like, thank you so much. So wonderful.
Yeah, but I would say thank you to you for having created such a wonderful product. It really is, actually. And it's the first time on this podcast that we've actually talked about a product in so much detail. We generally, the podcast has been about guests and their journey and their life. And I know we've covered that, but actually, I really wanted to talk about Jukes because I'm a massive, massive fan of it. I believe that, like, for all the retreats that we will do going forward, we'd always want to have Jukes at our retreat. I feel that what I was able to do was put it in front of 15 women who largely had a very positive reaction to it. Yes. Now, they'll all go back and form their own relationship with it, you know, or whatever. So I think that we can all do that. And I just think, you know, anything that is healthier and, you know, is something that we should be supporting and promoting. Yeah. So why not?
It's lovely to hear as well. I love hearing sort of, you know, feedback. You know, because it's a new brand as well. We get a lot of feedback. We have enormous customer retention on our, you know, from our website, and we get a lot of people taking photographs of, you know, how they're serving Jukes, what they're on their picnic, what they're eating with, you know, their Jukes. It's lovely because it inspires us as well.
I'm just excited to see how it evolves, and I think it will become. I hope it will become the signature kind of like cool alcohol alternative drink. People will start saying things like. And if you say, oh, you're having a drink tonight, and it'll be like, oh, no, I'm just going to Jukes it or something. Like, I think it's going to become the word to talk about, you know, like, have. And I think it's cool. That's the most important thing. It doesn't feel uncomfortable. Oh, I'm just having a Diet Coke or whatever. You know, it's got power. You know, it's a strong drink. It's great. It's brilliant. And now we've had three glasses and we're still sober.
Yes,
and
that's true.
Still just as interesting as we were at the beginning. No, it's absolutely brilliant. So look, before we wrap up, one question that we always ask our guests, and we should ask you too. So no, it's nothing complicated. So so this podcast is part of our retreat, Santalan, and Santalan is the Hindi word for balance.
Okay, yes.
So we always ask all of our guests, like, you know, especially you have a very busy life and you're building your business, how do you find balance in your life?
Balance is one of those words I use a lot because I use it for flavour.
Right. Okay.
So from cooking and drinks. Okay. So I'm always in search of balance.
Okay.
And do I find it personally? Yes, I do, because I have quite an exciting job quite a lot of the time. But what brings me back down to earth is my children, very much.
Right.
I've got two little boys and two older girls, both have left university, but I've got a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old sons. And they are very sobering. The conversations we're having are hilarious and often quite difficult to answer their questions. And I think that being lucky enough to have little kids as an older, let's say an older parent, is very enriching. And I think that rather offsets some of the sort of fine dining and the travelling and all the flash stuff I do. I think it's nice to get back down to earth.
Oh, lovely. What a nice answer. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming today. And thank you for being with me on the last podcast of the first series. It's so nice. And I'm so happy about what you've created. Congratulations and cheers. All the best.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Matthew Jukes is so much fun. And I think his brand, Jukes Cordialities, is an amazing concept. And I think it will probably become a part of many people's lives going forward. This is the end of the first series. Thank you so much for being on the journey with me. I'm really grateful for all of the support. Thank you to all of those people who have, you know, reached out to me and given me feedback on certain podcasts or the podcast in general. I've got certain friends who are ready to give me more feedback when I've got the time. So hopefully I'm going to have a little bit of downtime now to sit and reflect and work out how we can approach series 2. It's been really amazing. And although there's lots of learnings and I always know that, you know, I'm quite self-critical and I could always do better. I am actually just really proud that I made it happen. And for someone who hates the camera and hates the microphone, doing a podcast was a bit of a tall challenge, but we got there in the end. And it has been a really interesting ride. And I am looking forward to a bit of downtime and I'm looking forward to starting series 2 with a bang. So until then, stay safe and remember, nobody's coming to fix you because you have all the power within you. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Nobody's Coming to Fix You. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please follow us and subscribe for future episodes. If you have any questions about the content of this show, all the details will be in the show notes. You can also reach out to us on Instagram and TikTok at Santaland Coaching. Nobody's Coming to Fix You is brought to you by Santaland, a 12-month coaching and transformation program for women. To learn more, please go to www.santaland.com. I'm your host, Albea. Until next time, stay well.